Well, there you go. That seems to be about the best balance I can get between my voice and the music. Hopefully you can hear me all right out there. Apologies for any tunnel effects and other kind of far side sound effects you're likely to get. That's because on this occasion I'm coming to you just straight through whatever the laptop has to offer. We don't have any mics or headsets or anything like that. It seems to have been tweaked to do that out to the best it will do. That, of course, is going to be one of the more minor differences between myself and Vin, is that Vin definitely had it so that he came out sounding really smooth, and a wee crowded studio full of stuff to play with. The other big difference, obviously, between me and Vin is that he knows an awful lot more about what he's talking about than I do, and has had a lot more experience on, at this point, really just talking about it. I think it's worth saying a few words about the disappearance of TNS itself, really, at this point. Because, for me, the whole thing has served to provide a lot of not only a lot of clarity to my own mind and to kind of, if you like, kick certain ideas into touch and bring other ideas into the foreground that are worth considering, but it's also provided a level of society through TNS and Scottish Sovereigns on the Land that I never thought I'd actually experience. It's really brilliant to have so many people gathered in one place. And I guess it's not entirely surprising to find that there are some people who are perhaps not happy to see the kind of success that TNS is definitely having, not only in getting people together, but in coming up with solutions and techniques which are making it easier for people to stay alive and easier for people to feel happy with what it is that they're trying to do. And so I was on a bus trip on Friday up to stay with Jim and Laurie and catch up with many of the Scottish Sovs, where we are now obviously camping out, and I've been having a cracking time here. But it did mean that when I arrived at Glasgow bus station, the first thing I heard from Laurie was that TNS had been taken down. Of course, being as I'd been on the bus, I had no idea that anything was going on at all. I'm grateful though that coincidence and synchronicity has actually put me up here in amongst the action, rather than just hearing about it in the remote steppes of mid Wales. And it clearly is a huge disappointment to have what has happened happen. And especially for Vin, my thoughts go out to Vin and to his family, all the work that he's put in, and the fact that suddenly you find yourself having to step entirely to one side. But I think it's also clear to all of us, is it not, that certainly as the last 3 or 4 years and the last year have gone by, that things are speeding up no end, that the connection between intent and manifestation, which perhaps used to be many years separated, the two things used to be many separated by many years, it's now seems to be that intent can manifest in the very next moment. And of course we don't know what kind of manifestation it is that our thoughts are going to bring about. We don't know where we need to go next and how we're going to get there, because we're sort of groping along. But it has seemed to me in my life, as things have become less regular and more unpredictable, that by and large the results are turning out to be better than they would have been had I tried to stick with what was clearly an illusory security, for want of a better word. All things have to move on, it seems to me. My entire life basically has involved spending a lot of time doing things really intensely for relatively short periods of time. In my early life, I managed to last kind of 5 years at a given project. And by about year three, it would be kind of waning, and by year five, I'd have had enough of it. As time went by, I noticed that places where I'd been really welcome and valued for the early years, slowly but surely, for lots of different reasons, became places where I was no longer welcome, or where it was no longer possible for me to practice the things that I'd been practicing. And I don't remember at any point it being particularly difficult to abandon the thing that I'd been doing before in exchange for something that was almost by definition completely unknown right from the word go. I remember discovering that the point where something is comfortable to the point where something is no longer comfortable or viable can come really suddenly out of the blue, like simply overnight. and it might be, in my case to start with, it was the fact that I've been beavering away doing a good amount of work, and I do mean doing the kind of thing that Vin evidently must have done to get this whole thing to where it is now, which is committing more or less every moment of my waking life to the project in hand, to concentrating on giving it absolutely my best, to making the thing that had been put into my hands to manage as friendly and useful to the people in it and around it as it could possibly be. And I was willing to make, and still remain for the things I'm committed to, ready to make any sacrifice necessary to keep that going. Even, as I've said before, I discovered that my mind was even working on these things at night, that I'd wake up in a cold sweat early in the morning thinking of some obscure steel part that it was that I hadn't ordered that was necessary for something that was going out at the moment. And behold, when I got into my place of slavery the next day, I'd look at the records and find, yeah, indeed, I hadn't ordered the part I'd been dreaming about the night before. So it can be really difficult to even imagine how much work goes into pulling off these major projects. But still, right from the beginning, when the time came, and in that, the case of the one I'm remembering at the moment, it was the fact that in order to do from the shop floor what was basically an office job, it was agreed that I would be paid considerably more washers than I was getting when I was just kind of hacking around with a set of spanners. And that was just the first of many occasions when that particular promise turned out to be a bit of a white elephant, really. And as is inevitably the case, it seems to me, I ended up kind of losing out a little bit on the deal. But it didn't matter to me because I wanted to do the new stuff that it was that I was doing. But in the end, their part of the deal was that because I was going to be dealing with suppliers and a little bit with customers and stuff. Excuse me a moment. I can't. Let me just mute my mic and have a cough. A couple of days with the Scottish soz is taking its toll here. Yes, the part of the deal that this particular company or corporation made with me was that if they gave me a job with a bit more front end to it and paid me more money, then I would do something about my improving my appearance, which in those days was extremely furry indeed. I had a fair mass of head hair and a really big beard. And in the end, they chose to lean on me a bit and said, you know, do you remember when you took this job, you promised to improve your appearance? And it was a bit of an exchange. But basically they were trying to convince me to cut bits of my body off and weren't even willing to pay extra for it. And so in the end, it became necessary overnight to just go, oh, well, right, I'm just not going to do this anymore. I'm just going to leave. And that turned out to be a bit of a modus operandi of mine, as to do stuff whilst it was still really exciting, and when it ceased to be exciting, I would move on. And it's happened again and again at shorter and shorter periods. And in a way, I think that's kind of what's happened at TNS. I think we're now known as IMS, International Media Streaming. I'm not sure just exactly where it's all going, but the thing is, the time always comes to move on. I've also in my time spent, say, a couple of years at a time working for voluntary or community, what are effectively voluntary and community projects, two or three of which, in my opinion, have had the ability to become sort of major forces for good. They've had published books, they've got new ideas that clearly ring, or had new ideas that clearly ring true demonstrably with the people that they're trying to move these ideas onto. And yeah, there was always a bit of a problem in giving them longevity. But see, in nearly all of these cases, there was a head, if you like, there was a leader. I think probably the best term to use for such things is visionary minds. Whoever it was that came up with these ideas was the person who was driving it along. My first sort of professional experience of that was working for a company called Solid State Logic that made and still make these really beautiful mixing desks that are used in most of the recording studios throughout the world. They also make, we also made some pretty plush cinema recording broadcasting desks that were due, that were able to mix sound and vision. And when I started there, the man who'd built the first mixing desk in his garage, and so had become, if you like, the seed of this entire, by then, 160-man company, had done all the work from scratch in his garage. He'd, bit by bit, got all of the bits that he needed to make one of these things, and he'd made one, and it went down really well. And he used to come into the factory when things really needed to be done quickly, and he used to roll up his sleeves, bring in pizzas and beer and all of that, and help us get it out. And over time, the company was bought up by first one corporate interest, and then another, and then another. And as the man from his garage was sidelined, the thing changed. Now, in your professional sphere where people are being paid, albeit in debt, to work with each other and to get something out the door, it's almost like the need for money keeps everybody together. In some companies it works really well, but less and less so as the corporation takes over, as it becomes more attractive, as it were, to the predators. And the same is true of the little amateur things, the sort of charity things that I involved myself in. One of them was a colour therapy college in Gloucestershire, which was easily one of the weirdest places that I've ever tried to live and work. And the visionary head at the top of that one was a character called Theophilus Heliodor Gimbal, now no longer with us, who had a whole load of tales, fancied himself as the 39th Prince of Burgundy, he did, and was keen enough on this to even bring it up when he went down the local chip shop to get chips and the like. And the place had a grand character to it. We ran colour therapy courses over weekends during the year, and we also had a summer course which ran for a couple of weeks. We had a couple of international colour festivals in the sort of grounds of this ancient place where Theo lived. And his was popular stuff. I think that the school of colour therapy is still being used by some people. But in the process of doing all of this stuff, we had many brilliant people through the place on courses. We also had quite a lot of people who came and sort of hung out, kicked back in the place, and helped keep it running. We used to grow quite a lot of food in the kitchen garden and feed it to the people who came on the courses. And one of my main tasks in the place was to be like kitchen porter. So I got to meet all of these people as they came and hung around in the kitchen for a chat. We had lots of brilliant volunteers through the place, many of whom could have taken on the responsibilities that Theo himself was managing, some of which were pretty everyday things and that needed doing, really, in a way, to save Theo's time and give him a bit of room to develop his ideas and do what he was really good at, which was kind of hosting the whole gig, as it was. But this was kind of one example of a place where, if you like, the visionary mind that began the whole thing found it extremely difficult to let go of the critical parts, what he felt were the critical parts of the operation. And as such, none of the volunteers that were coming to the place were ever really used to their full potential. In fact, to a great extent under circumstances like that, everybody is pretty much, to a great extent, doing what they're told. They might be told how to do it really nicely, but doing what you're told is what it is. So effectively, there ends up being no way for new people in the place to take a bit of the responsibility off the shoulders of the visionary head. And there also isn't, as a result of that, there isn't the opportunity either for new developments, for the original material, for the core of the project, if you like, to grow and to develop into something new, which is what everything inevitably needs to do if it's going to survive. It needs to move a little bit with the times, it needs to become better at what it does, and it needs one way or the other to be able to pull in a bit more material. And it certainly needs to be able to make use of new and younger minds to make sure that the thing that you're doing gets more colour and depth. And it seems to me that sometimes it's, most of the time, it's not we as human beings that are in charge of the timing of when these things occur. It seems to me that we're certainly in charge of the intent. We're certainly responsible for the clarity of our mind and our hearts as it is that we push forward in whatever project it is that we're doing. But we can't really either dictate when things happen or predict what's going to happen or when. And perhaps what it is that's happened with TNS is that a whole load of really, really valuable work has been done. It's already had, in the short time I've been with it, a couple of years, it's had some major challenges, which it not only rode through, but it came out the other end quite noticeably stronger than when the challenge arose. I was also struck both times, I'm thinking, I guess particularly of the time when Awake Radio was born and several regular hosts of the station moved away with little or no warning. And it comes as a bit of a shock. It came as a bit of a shock, certainly, and there's a fair bit of confusion. But even when that happened, I was struck by the solidarity of purpose at TNS and by the fact that very quickly any holes that were left were filled with newer, brighter stars than were in there before. And I've especially appreciated that particular change over the last weekend when, having heard on my arrival in Glasgow that TNS was no more, when I saw that everybody had arrived at Scottish Sovereigns on the Land, that some clearly brave, enthusiastic and competent souls had successfully taken the huge and complex operation that's carrying all these podcasts and video, that's carrying a chat box for real-time information between people. We've got things, little things like the on-air button, and you've obviously got the radio player and all of that. To find that the whole thing had been successfully shifted sideways and was whirring away smoothly was a heartwarming experience. And I think that is probably one of the signs that the move that we've just experienced was ready to happen, as it were. It shows, I think, a huge robustness about the station, which didn't exist, for example, in the colour therapy college that I was talking about, and one or two others. I've had this experience before where people who've had good ideas don't somehow or another, they aren't somehow or other able to hand it on in such a way that a bigger, better thing can be carried forward by more people. And it seems to me that as well as spending such an immense amount of time getting the actual structure of TNS together and making it work, Vin must have either through reason and logic or just by instinct have been managing to distribute responsibility amongst the many hosts and admin people who really helped keep the whole show on the road. He was not a man for hanging on to what it was that he was building, and clearly, in order to have been able to do so tidily what he has done, there was a lot of really good work done, and I'd really like to thank Vin for all of that. I'd especially like to thank him for the versatility that enabled him to stand to one side, and the versatility that enabled all the other people who have kept it going since that fatal or potentially fatal moment. And say that really the nature of the beast as a result has changed, because clearly looking at some of the stuff that's been passing around, there was an impression out there that what was keeping TNS going was Vin's overriding ego. That's one of the things I read that particularly struck me, because it seems anyway to most of us, I'm sure, that that is not a fair comment. And I'd say that the fact that TNS has handed itself over and is still running in so many other hands shows that what got it running was not ego, but a determination to make something that works well. And that is what it is that we've ended up with. So in fact, it's one of the old stories, isn't it? It comes in the form, in many forms, but the one I was familiar with it was the story of the alchemist and his apprentice. Alchemy is a secret art, and one of the reasons why it was secret was because really, at least it was perceived to be entirely related to the ability to turn out not just money, but real wealth, shall we call it, in the form of gold. And as a result, alchemists were constantly getting themselves into trouble, especially from kings and princes, and those who felt themselves to have the voice of power, because that kind of influence would be really useful. We have seen how much use people can make out of machines that print money. And so your alchemist was trying to actually progress much more than just the making of gold, but it's a suitable enough metaphor that you're trying to turn out a perfect product of some sort. And all of the symbols and the different language and many, many other things were used by the alchemists to not only conceal what they were doing from the voices of power, but to make sure that they could actually communicate it to each other. And there's obviously, I think, a bit of alignment there between what the alchemists were doing and what we're doing here, because we too are dealing with two different languages. We too are trying to move things on in a way which can be made available to others who find themselves under pressure with their butts against the wall, whilst not necessarily bringing to the attention of the people who would get in our way just exactly what it is that's going on. I know there's many things going on that are happening pretty much under the radar at the moment, and I've no doubt will explode onto the scene at some point. But anyway, in order for your alchemist or the modern day equivalent to succeed, he really needs to have an apprentice. They always do. They have somebody who they can teach the things that they've learned to. And it's said in the alchemist tales and in the tales of developing magicians and sorcerers and other people who are dealing on the private side, that knowledge obviously is power. And certainly knowledge in these critical realms, shall we say, the realms where physical change or substantive change in the world can come about as a result of the work that's being done. You are inevitably taking on a degree, if you're any good at it at all, you're taking on a degree of influence, a degree of power, a degree of control, which is being made and defined by the knowledge that you're gaining as you go along. And it's not entirely untrue, it's probably not quite entirely true either, that power corrupts, and that absolute power corrupts absolutely. But certainly as you move towards a position of more power, it is perhaps human nature, perhaps it's the fact that we've been conditioned into this particular human nature, but there is a tendency to exercise that power. And so it's kind of recognized in these old myths and stories that at some point the alchemist is going to hand on all that he's left to his apprentice, and the apprentice will then have to carry on with the work. I feel that what's been birthed here is a thing that is complete and ready, a bit like a hatching egg, or perhaps a caterpillar turning into a butterfly. And now we have a new thing to play with, folks. There's going to be all of us working together. Vin's voice is itself going to be, I feel, more or less impossible to replace. We have several people who've spoken on TLS in the past who have a similar level of knowledge and a similar ability to use the ideas that and materials that are coming to them. And I feel that Vin's voice was unique and comfortable and generous, I felt. And whilst the station, I'm sure, will go from strength to strength in its new form, I'm personally really going to miss that warm voice on a Sunday evening. And I guess we're all going to have to up our game a little bit. I think that everybody's ready to do that. All the people out there listening, all of the hosts. I just see it going from strength to strength. So after that little bit, I'm going to play another couple more tunes and see what it is that I can come up with to fill a little bit of space with some voice this evening. It's obviously quite a challenge coming at it completely clean and in a foreign country and all of that, but I'm sure something will come out of me in a few minutes or so. So I'm going to play two or three more tunes. There will be more tunes than Vin normally plays, because honestly, I've got lots to say, but I I don't have as much to say as Vin. The other thing is, I think I'd really like to be able to call somebody, get somebody to call in and have a chat with me, which we might try a little bit later on, but I really don't think the technology is going to be up to that. So one way or the other, you're stuck with the Doctor's thoughts and with the Doctor's music collection. You're listening to Dr. Rock taking the place, trying to take the place of Vin on what was TNS Radio and is now IMS Radio. And I think perhaps what I'd like to try and do in between some of the tunes is imagine a little just exactly what kind of jurisdiction it is that we're seeking for ourselves here. Because clearly there's many of us, probably all of us, on the Scottish Sovereigns on the Land, .ning.com and scotlandisfree.ning.com and many other places who are listening carefully to the anecdotes that are told by the many, many characters that come across on the various radio shows that are put across here. And imagining just exactly how it is that we might deal with similar situations as they arise about us. Without doubt, such attention is definitely paying off for people, as has been said before, especially on Vin's last week's show on Sunday, when I thought he and Harry were on particularly fine form. And it's been pointed out that people who feel themselves to be under such serious threat from the administration that they commit suicide, that they no longer feel able to keep up, from farmers, you know, it's been happening to farmers for a long time, the suicide rate amongst them is really high, but now it's happening to people on benefit, to people even who really have been doing their best to keep up with their patently illegal mortgage contracts and the rest, and even though they're trying to do that, they're still having their doors kicked in by a bunch of thugs without recourse and without warning. And the information that's now coming out of TNS is enabling some of such people to ease their load and to give themselves a bit of space and time to think. And this is very good. This is absolutely excellent, because more and more people are turning up, more and more people are finding themselves taking a bit of a beating at the hands of what we might nominally call the state corporation and its various squid-like arms. And as a result, they're finding themselves to groping their way, like the rest of us, towards information which is going to help, and they're happy themselves individually to engage with it. But for the mass of the people in these islands and the people in the world, that is unlikely to be possible, or unlikely to be coming too soon, because it's very difficult to step aside from a thing that you've been trained and conditioned and in just so many different ways caused to believe that what it is you're seeing and understanding, what you're understanding and comprehending by what you see, is in any sense real. And the moving away from that seldom happens, at least to date, it seldom seems to happen just as a result of waking up one morning and thinking, sod it, I'm just not going to comply anymore. It normally comes about because circumstance slowly but surely degrades around us and leaves us with absolutely no choice. And as Vin himself said, once the Orgia hits the air conditioning, it's not just a little bit of our domestic or regular secure system that goes down, it's all of it, because there's a tendency to try and turn our back on things that change, to just not deal with what it is that's coming up, and then another little thing goes wrong, and in the end, the thing that sends us down the rabbit hole is the thing that pulls the rug out from under our feet entirely. And that is a difficult process to undertake willingly, and also all of our conditioning trains us not to do that. So it's necessary, perhaps, or it would be helpful perhaps, to start thinking about just what exactly it is that we might want to do for all of the people around us who, for many, many reasons, are not in a position to take the initiative on such things. It's not possible for some people, it's not desirable for many other people, to even begin to understand all of the complex stuff that gets discussed in the TNS chat box, and I know several of my friends who have joined up and had a look at it for the first two or three visits. It is a complete mystery, and many people, I think, are just switched off by anything that's going to require anything more than two or three thoughts to pull it together. And the techniques that are being used by the world management team to make sure they get to hold on to all of their stuff and not have it removed from them by an angry and righteous populace is, of course, the business of your trust. And one of the first things that I certainly did once a pile of my nominal stuff was removed from the garden was to create a private family trust for myself and for the Synchro Sister. I realized a long time ago that it's not possible to actually own anything or have title to it. My one experience with bailiffs and the corporation that was the county council, with whom I was having a bit of a disagreement at the time. They definitely showed by their behaviour that they certainly didn't think that I had title to anything. And so family trust looked to me to be a pretty good way of basically making sure that I didn't own anything anyway, because it's being held in trust for future generations. One of the reasons why I chose to jump ship, as it were, and why I'm considering resigning from the whole shooting match is because, I lost my thought there, that one's particularly gone. But basically, it does, I think, the trust business does make it very much more difficult to have any stuff off you because it's not your stuff in the first place. And this certainly has been shown, I think, amongst people that I'm mixing with in various Skype rooms and stuff, to be quite a successful way of making sure that the few things that we do feel that we need to get along with are going to be harder to be prized out of our grasp. And perhaps one of the things that needs to be considered is the drawing together of just such a trust for all of us, and work is being done on exactly that. It's perhaps helpful to remember that we are by far and away not the only nation that's under the cosh, and many individual nations, particularly in North America and Central America, found themselves being completely overrun by a jurisdiction that they stood absolutely no chance of understanding at all. And for many, many years, that's the way it stood. For many years, these peoples just lost their livelihood. They lost the ability and the freedom to do the things that they used to have the ability and the freedom to do. Their health systems, their cultural systems, their systems of myth and systems of social coherence were entirely undermined. This was especially by the introduction of different languages, which meant that they could no longer even express the ideas that they used to have, and they became entirely subordinate cultures. In fact, many of them almost died out entirely. And we could see the number of individual nations disappearing. I'm sure they never bothered to declare themselves in paper as individual nations, because there was no need for them to do it. They were existing in trust amongst themselves, and to a greater or lesser extent in trust and trade with the communities and nations that lived amongst them. And eventually it became apparent that these nations, there were voices in them, just like there's voices in our nations now, that are saying this is simply slavery and it's completely against human rights, the freedom for every individual to be equal to every other individual. And minds in those cultures started working on a way of creating a jurisdiction which would enable them once again to express their own power rather than to have power exerted over them. To perhaps try start exercising power with rather than power over. And the way they started doing this was to declare their indigenousness, as you like, their nativeness to the land in which they were born, and their right to express their own culture, their own literature, their own religious beliefs. And in order to do this, they started writing treaties. And I think a treaty is more or less defined as a written agreement between two or more sovereign nations. And in this particular brand of international law, it seems that in order to be sovereign, you have to have somebody else that agrees you're sovereign. Now, we know that is not absolutely the case, but nonetheless, it's as useful a thing to work on as anything else, I think. And so, people's indigenous rights, their ability to talk to each other and express their own free will, started to arise in the countries of Central and some of the nations, some of the old nations of North America. And it got to the point where treaties were being signed between one and the other. And so there was a degree of recognition in international law of the existence of things that are previously thought to have been written off, rubbed out, and made non-existent. It also became necessary, once there are now, I think, several hundred of these little mini sovereign nations setting themselves up within the existing legislatures, such as it is, and it became necessary for the people of these nations to travel to meetings to see each other, and at that point it became necessary that they have passports, and so to fit in with the requirements of the nations that they were going to have to be travelling through or to, and the right of their ability to raise their own travel documents is recognised and now also made capable for them. So treaties are turning out to be a great way of creating things and embedding them that, if you like, a bit from the old times, but we may well find new uses for them as it is, as more and more people join this loose association of people that wishes to pull itself out of slavery and reassert its own rights to do that which it wants to do on the nation that is planet Earth. Oh, thank you very much, Laurie. That's been nicely. We need to consider community. Basically, we are a group of sentient beings living together in a common unity, but the unity that we're making is distinctly lumpy. And one of the reasons why this is happening, I've only realised it myself fully, really, in recent days. I noticed a long time ago that using texts on a mobile phone to communicate with people works very well, so long as you're communicating with people who know you well, who are of a like mind, and who are unlikely under any circumstances to misinterpret whatever message it is that you're trying to get across. Now, this is of course a very, very difficult thing, because any message that is sent to us can only be understood through our own experience, our own training, our own mental furniture. So whatever it is that the other person or the other individual sends to me is only understandable to me by the means I've come to understand things in the past. And as a result, we can only be responsible for the transmission of the message. We cannot at all be responsible for the way it is received. And some of the people I've had to deal with in the past, in sort of particularly tricky situations, one is obviously aware, is one not, when one is dealing with people who are edgy, touchy, nervous, likely to be easily upset. There are many people like that. It's their way of doing things. It's the path that they're on. And so it is that even when one tries really, really hard to write an absolutely clear and unequivocal message, which is designed specifically not to upset the person with whom one might be dealing, it is still possible to send that innocent text message and for it to be received by somebody who's had a particularly bad night's sleep or who's just had a particularly unfortunate run of circumstances, which makes it impossible for them to take anything on board without suspicion or with happiness. And so it can be that even the simplest text, written, you know, just black letters on a white background, whatever it is, can be wholly misinterpreted. And even though the aim was honest and to make progress, what is made instead is a good degree of trouble, which in itself then perhaps has to be sorted out with further text. And watching the chat boxes at TNS and Scottish Sovereigns over the years has yielded, if you like, a bit of fur on the skin of that particular theory of the difficulty of the written word in terms of actually making any kind of meaningful communication. Because obviously there's a huge variety of people in the chat boxes, and they all express themselves on particular subjects and in particular ways. And some of them I feel completely in tune with and feel almost like, you know, you could share a house with them at the drop of a hat. Other people, you can look at the input that's arriving in the chat box and in the various blogs and stuff, and you can think, well, I'm not sure about that. And I've realised that rather than make any kind of judgment on the people as a result of my interpretation of the text that I'm reading, under those circumstances, the only thing really to do is to meet the individual in the flesh and spend some time with your electrochemical system interacting with theirs, because that's the only way of getting to see where the honest lie of the land, where the honest direction of the text is going. So a group of sentient beings living together in common unity is going to have to be extremely careful about the way it understands anything that's written. Really, the only way of it dealing with itself is going to be face to face. But that being the case, there is obviously a bit of a workaround, in my opinion. And the workaround is that all messages received by text, actually in writing in front of your eyes, if you can't hear the voice or see the body, they really have to be taken as more or less value-free statements. It's not possible to make any kind of judgment on what it is you're thinking or seeing, because you're only getting a kind of really the subtlest hint of what it is that the person might be thinking or where it is that the individual might be coming from. And this is clearly one of the big problems that we've got, I think, because whenever something good arises, it seems to me, in this world, there is something slightly tainted that arises with it. And I've read some of the stuff that was that has been said about Vin, published literally, because it is in writing. I'm not in a position to stick a link in. I know that Laurie gave me a long document of stuff yesterday. And what it's doing is it's allowing individuals to make claims about other individuals, which in itself ain't a problem. If we were just going to look at the text and just go, oh, well, look, there's something that bloke thinks about this bloke, and I can't make any sense of it because I don't really know either of them. Instead of doing that, there is a tendency for people, many people, I think, just to believe what they read, and I was the same. I was like that for ages until I became aware of this kind of a subtle void that actually exists there. And so it is that, people like, commonly known as Dom, the man who I call the Mr. Marmite of the association of non-compliant, in that you either love him or you hate him. He attracts a lot of attention to himself and does that deliberately, and people write a lot of things about Dom in a lot of places. And, you know, we're all different. Personally, I'll always, as people who listen to Dr. Rock regularly will know, I'll always express my friendship and support for Dom. I can understand where people are coming from, because I know him and I know some of them. But his approach is his approach. And so no matter how many people tell me that Dom is dodgy because they've read it on the internet, I'm going to have a bit of difficulty with that, because I'm not sure they've met him. In fact, it does have to be said that in that particular case, I know that even the arrival of Dom can make householders nervous, because I've seen it with my very own eyes. But inevitably, and without exception, when he actually arrives on the premises and goes away again, people are well happy with what they've met and with what's happened between them. So the ability to read something about somebody you don't know and whose work you don't understand and just take it on board is, I guess, a common disease that we're all suffering from. It goes beyond just taking an unknown person's opinion of another unknown person. It's the same sort of thing that enables many of the people we talk to simply turn off, to invoke a slide response and just chuck the words conspiracy theory at you and think, well, you know, that's that. That's the job done. It's like saying, yeah, I hear what you're saying. And even though I understand that you've been watching this and reading about it and listening to things and experiencing it in your own life, even though I know you've been doing that for the last 30 years or so in a fair degree of detail, because I haven't looked into it and because I'm told that what you're talking is bollocks, then what you're talking is bollocks. So if we're going to get a community together, a group of sentient beings that can live together in common unity, then we have to be, I guess, a lot more open to our own foibles, a lot more understanding of the fact that everybody is doing what they need to do at this moment in time. But it especially means that listening to unhelpful information, it should always be taken with a pinch of salt. And perhaps better still, that's to do with the interpretation of what comes to us and how other people might interpret it. But really, I think that personally the conclusion I've come to on that particular subject is that when there is nothing useful to say, then nothing should be said. What else can you do? If you're going to find yourself in a position where you're going to be critical or unhelpful, and criticism I think is always unhelpful, then it's better to stay silent. So the point one would be not to stir the crap for people in the first place, not to put stuff out there that people might misunderstand or might work to the disadvantage of somebody else. Because if that individual really deserves to be worked to the disadvantage of, then their own work and their own words and the deeds that they are doing will be quite enough to do that job. It is not necessary for any other individual or any other flesh and blood entity to add their 10 penneth, to stick their big spoon in the porridge and start stirring it. And so part of the tendency not to put any of the bad stuff out there is not to believe it when people do, because it seems to me that there has to be an unsound motivation behind such attacks. Second part of that would be when we're conversing with other individuals, as well as not saying anything, if we haven't got anything useful to say, we might consider maintaining interest, even if what is being said is patently insane, because the other person's on their own path. But nearly always, in such circumstances, we hear things which we feel to be worthy of support. Even the craziest amongst us is able to say things that are supportable and are useful ideas. So perhaps nodding, supporting and trying to extend anything useful that is said is also a good idea. And then the other thing is to only put the useful stuff out there, and that again is a point that's capable of refinement. In order to do that, we have to understand the difference between that which sometimes works and that which never works. And even that's not really in its way, that's not really refinement enough, because no matter how good the information is, if the useful stuff we're saying has too many words in it, or wanders about the place too much, or has words that are likely to switch people off in it, then again, what we're doing is preventing ourselves from getting our own message across. Whereas these very experiments themselves, we deal again and again. I'm sure you're all the same, I know I do, and I know Simon Spaniard has this as well. But time and time and time again, we end up dealing with a new person, a new individual, and another meeting on the street or whatever, which requires us once more to cover a subject, whatever it is, you know, the straw man, the money, the mortgage, I think they're pretty common main themes, requires us to cover the same thing again and again. And my experience suggests that to start with, it's quite difficult to be prompt enough, to be sharp enough, to be clear enough, to get in under the barriers of the other person before they've switched off and done their little slide response on you. So, as well as ensuring that the subjects we're going to talk about are suited to the individual that we're trying to communicate with. We need to, I think it's helpful to pay attention each and every time we go for one of these subjects with one of these individuals, to pay close attention to what works and what doesn't. Because a bit like your stand-up comic, who could only find out what works by putting himself in front of an audience and seeing whether he lives or dies, the stuff that gets a little bit of a laugh on the first night is going to be kept in and worked on a little bit. Maybe the laugh will disappear the next night, in which case it's a failed hypothesis. Maybe you'll sustain the laugh. Maybe you'll get a much bigger laugh than you got last time. And it's a technique. It's a matter of experimenting with our communication. And we can do that. There are some things that you appear to be able to say to almost anybody that work every time. And seeking for those expressions in ourselves, seeking for a unity between subject matter and means of expression, which comes across quickly to whoever it is we want, is another important point. So not speaking, not saying that which isn't useful, supporting that which is useful, and trying unfailingly to put out stuff which can only be looked back on, because it's all published, can only be looked back on with smiles and with approbation, is a great way to start. If we stop poisoning the field with unjust and unwanted opinions of other people, we will be doing ourselves loads of favours. And if we stop taking on board the nonsense that can be written about one person, about one individual, by another individual, we will be doing ourselves some favours. We'll be doing favours to both of the individuals concerned as well. And I think perhaps it's also worth pointing out that anybody who is constantly shouting the word ego in terms of what their conference, their subject matter or whatever, is almost certainly projecting, and that the problem with the ego is somewhere else entirely. So this business of a community, is that this idea of sentient beings living together in common unity is a nice simple way of putting it, but the actual practice is difficult. And the words I've just spoken really, I think, come about from the fact that over the last 18 months I've lived in many different places with many different people, and all of them, their intents are great. You know, what they're trying to do is undoubtedly valid and requires not the consent of others, and would, if it were to come about, be extremely useful, not only to the people who are trying to do it, but possibly also many times for the people around them. And yet, these are little groups of individual unities, individual little teams, that are, without doubt, having success, some success in what they're doing. But what isn't being managed is a common unity between these various groups of people. And that inevitably comes about, it seems to me, not because people don't want to cooperate, because I think they basically do, but because it's all too easy to get ourselves hung up on something that's being done by another individual or another group of individuals with which we can't personally agree. And if that's the case, then all sorts of other things are not agreed upon, and so progress isn't made. To actually be able to stand back and look at what other people are doing, and to be grateful for it and for the methods they're using, so long as they're not causing themselves or anybody else any harm or damage, is, I think, a really sound approach. There's no need anyway, really, to be critical of other people's approaches. It's, in a way, a kind of denial to look at what somebody else is doing and to imagine that if we have their background and education and parents and all the rest of it, that we would do anything different, because we probably wouldn't. So in a way, any form of criticism is simply denial. Denial at best, and projection of our own insecurities at worst. So I think communities living together in common unity, and when they can do that, having a treaty which actually declares the unity and the progress that they want to make, and treaties with other people in similar situations. They're like little imaginary sovereign groups, if you like. And another critical word in all of this would, have to be trust, which we might define as the faithful reliance upon that which we do not control. And we don't really control anything. Again, something that's becoming more and more apparent to all of us. 10, 20 years ago, it was certainly much more easy for me to imagine what was going to happen tomorrow and for tomorrow to turn out pretty much predictably as I expected it to do. Over time, that has more or less completely ceased to be. It seems that any level of planning and preparation and getting in of stuff and mental preparation, physical fitness, raw materials for what's needed. In the old days, having all of that and getting it piled up was enough to get the job done. But now, it seems to me to be literally the case that quite complex intents and quite complex preparations can really easily just dissolve in the morning mist, as it were, so that something that looked like it was going to keep you busy for the next week or two is suddenly not possible. And at that point, it just has to be let go, or the stuff has to be left in a small heap or whatever, until the time comes right for it to be used. And that's the thing that we really don't control, in my opinion, is the timing of all of this, is when and how things manifest. And the business of trust has become absolutely central to my life, really, because as I've said, as soon as one chooses to leave a stone address and effectively remove the ability by standard means to get into another one, one is moving away from the illusion of security that goes with all of that stuff and moving into a situation completely of trust. Because a bit like when I jacked in that first job, it was a very, very comfortable place to be. I had absolutely none of the qualifications to do it and was, I admit, very lucky to get it. I was really enjoying doing it and all that sort of stuff. But when the time came to move on, moving on had to be done. Well, so what kind of jurisdiction might we imagine? What is it that we want to achieve and how might we achieve it is a pretty major question that I think all of us are addressing in our own individual ways. And one of the things that's it seems to me is becoming clearer as time goes by is that our own protection, as it were, our own strength lies in saying nothing and keeping saying nothing, because the moment you open your mouth, you're admitting to them that in some sense, in their terms, you actually exist. And that, under pressure, and when it's needed, is exactly and only the only way to go, as I have found out to my own cost. That was a good lesson learned early. But I think, as Dom Adequate, commonly known as Dom Adequately, demonstrates, you can actually get away with, as somebody in the chat box pointed out, when I was looking just now, that he talks to him all the time and has his own methods for doing all of that and, you know, getting in and out of the court and stuff. And by and large, it seems to work pretty well for him. We also know that there's many anecdotes on the TRS podcast, which I'm sure are now available at the Scottish Sovereigns on the Land. There's many anecdotes from people who are interacting with men in uniformed styles of dress, men carrying various plastic badges, trying to convince you of things that they have no right to convince you of, and dealing with techniques that, when we are forced into a dialogue, when we are forced to converse with these people, at least turn it into something of an interesting game. But really, if all we're going to do is say nothing and keep saying nothing, if we're not going to adopt to some extent the approaches taken by Vin and by people like Pete in his cases with the council tax, then all we're ever going to be able to do is, as it were, keep the ball on our side of the pitch. We're going to find ourselves, as we have been, I feel, for the last couple of years or so, basically standing around our own penalty area, trying to stop somebody else sticking a pig's bladder in the back of our net. And to a certain extent, I'm just getting a bit of feedback here, let me try turning that down, that's better. To a certain extent, the practice we've had on doing the defensive thing has informed the possibility of doing making slightly more strategic plays to see if we can't get some possession in the other half of the game board, as it were. And that does seem to mean a degree of interlocution. I think it's also fair to say that simply the exercising of the various techniques that become apparent on TNS, and to a certain but lesser extent in other places, is that simply by exercising our rights to non-compliance, by trying to avoid giving our consent, by trying to avoid ceding subject matter jurisdiction, by trying to avoid these things, and by dealing with the consequences, there are a whole load of people who get to witness what is going on. And I suppose they apply right away from the relatively more or less completely uninformed lower levels of the police up through, you know, court ushers to I don't know, secretaries, people that are handling any stuff that's being sent back with a handy little notice on it, all of that kind of stuff, because it does have a tendency in a good number of applications to work, means that plenty of individuals are being made aware that the situation they find themselves working in or attending or whatever reason they have for being there is not entirely what it's set out to be. The things they see happening in front of them might be a complete mystery to them. I should think they probably normally are. But nonetheless, the conditioning that's placed upon us only works really well so long as we don't see other people breaking the conditioning. There was that famous experiment which involved, I believe, a man in a white coat with a clipboard and an experimental subject sitting in front of a keyboard. And the idea basically is that there's a guy somewhere wired into the other end of the keyboard, and that as you work your way up from the lower octaves to the higher ones, he's receiving basically bigger electric shocks or being subjected to larger amounts of pain, painful stimuli of one sort or another. And it was found in the Stanley Milgram experiment, I think it was called. Was it that one? Probably was. Anyway, it was found that most people would, under the influence of a suitably authoritative white coat, carry on up the pain scale, carry on hearing the man screaming ever louder, and yet would continue even beyond the point where the man had stopped screaming for whatever reason. But there was recently done a slight enhancement to that experiment, in which there was an extension to the subject, as it were, so that the individual who was going to get given access to the keyboard and the inflicting of pain on the chap behind the glass was allowed to see the preceding experimental subject doing the experiment, as it were, or at least that's what they were told. In fact, in those experiments, the individual that was using the keyboard to inflict the pain was also part of the experiment rather than a subject, but that was not the impression given to the individual who was going to be subjected to this treatment. And it turned out, if I remember rightly, that if an incoming subject got to see a character on the keyboard who went all the way up to 100% and was, you know, just happy not to stop, then apparently 9 out of 10 of the people who saw that happening would do the same thing. It would appear that the other thing is true as well, though. If the incoming subject was to see the nominal subject that was preceding them just refuse point blank to cause the man any more pain than was absolutely necessary, and eventually to refuse to press any more keys at all, then 9 out of 10 of the following subjects would follow that particular example. So it's important, I think, on that kind of basis, to realise that everything we do that is done peacefully and productively and that is shown to have a result is going to make a large-scale difference to anybody that's witnessing that, both the people who know what's going on and the people who don't. And that, in that sense, there is kind of no need, perhaps, for a larger organisation or movement or administration to actually manage all of the stuff that is we're doing, because every single one of us that comes up with any kind of technique at all and exercises it in front of others is making a difference beyond any that we could even really possibly imagine. And it's known now as well that the effects we have on our friends, be they kind or nasty or whatever it is we're doing with our friends, that there's means now of measuring and tracing the response that that has throughout the social network, throughout the wider social network. And so it now seems to be pretty clear, once again from some pretty entertaining experiments, that kindnesses that we show to people around us manifest much further out in the social networks than we might imagine. So it is that a kindness visited upon a friend of ours, somebody who we know well, will actually be measurable out beyond that individual to his or her friends, and even to the friends of the friends of the individual that is being so treated. So it's not even just the individuals that are witnessing all of this, seeing a well-executed plan, a well-turned game move, whoever's terms we want to put it into. It's not just the people who witness it directly who are experiencing the impact. It's also people they know and people who are known by the people they know. So on that basis, we could quite easily see how, just carrying on as we are, we're going to have a significant and long-lasting effect on the system upon which we need to have a long-lasting effect. But there are people out there working towards what we might call a community solution. Some of the ideas that I was coming up with just before the last burst of music come from the website of the Universal Community Trust, which I think can still be found at freetheplanet.net. And they're experimenting with these ideas of sovereign nations, sovereign jurisdictions, and treaties to validate such things. Because these, of course, all take us into the realm of international law. And actually exercising this stuff for me is a bit of an experiment. Out of all the things that I came across, and as early listeners will remember, I spent time at the Out of the Ordinary Festival and at various other fields, the Green Gathering we went to the Off-Grid Festival as well. There were several. And I was working with a bunch of people known as Avalon Rising. And one of the things we did regularly, and some of them can be found on the Dr. Rock podcast page, was we held what we called Freeman Forums, for want of a better word, really. And the idea was that we'd get a cluster of whichever presenters were best suited to sitting on a nominal panel. And generally, by the time we had the Freeman Forum, we'd probably have 20 of our presenters actually on site with us, so we had a fair variety of people to pick from. We had Darren DOG, we had John Witterick came on quite a lot. Michael of Benicia from the Universal Community Trust was also quite frequently present, and you can hear all of those voices. I think Litmus was there from projectfreeman.com. You can hear all of these voices in the podcast. But it did, whilst I was in my early studies with TNS and Mr. T and the rest of it, it did give me access to many other approaches, all of which were dealing with different aspects of the problem. So John Witterick's website, getoutofdebtfree.org, is well known and is, as recommended earlier in this show, progressing and changing and growing, changing its techniques, enhancing them, moving with the times, and helping out countless people, really, who have, and turning what appear to be insoluble problems into clear and executable solutions. So John Witterick, there's Litmus himself, who was one of the early freemen, I think, in the UK, who did actually manage to deregister his car and get out of a couple of police stops, but is now busking for cheese and writing great songs, one of which I'm sure we'll play later, over on the continent. Michael of Benicia's approach is that is to do with, really, the as far as we can, the simple protection of people who can't or are not really able to learn materials in detail, and perhaps don't have the confidence or the wherewithal which is going to be another really common problem, to actually perform the moves in the ways they need to be done, because we need to be so calm, so peaceful, a degree of confidence or need is necessary before that can actually be done. And so a structure of trusts was kind of recommended, really, the idea being that things like the kind of private trust set up by us and many other people I know now, the idea is to try and group them together if we can, get them all to be beneficiaries of community trusts which are formed around their environs. All of this, of course, makes stuff extremely difficult to look at by anybody who's not entitled to look at. And one of the things that the freetheplanet.net people have been working on, I know more or less since the beginning, is the idea of a treaty which sets out some of the aims and conditions, if you like, of the trusts themselves, to state a bit like a kind of statutory declaration, but it's kind of for a group of people, of aims and conditions under which we will work. And in that process, I think they've covered many of the things that are causing us problems and offer many of the solutions.
Thank you very much.
And I believe the treaty can be seen on the freetheplanet.net website, actually. It's, I think, 10 or 11 in all are the things that are on it. There's a bit of other wordage as well. But it's a way of actually focusing intent. That's what I really like about it. There's so much information we have to deal with, and we are having such a difficult time. Things are moving so quickly around us that to have some basic principles against which to judge the things we're doing, and against which to be able to measure, if you like, a kind of benchmark against which we can measure information that's coming to us and offers that are being made to us. It's really useful to have some overall idea of where we're going, and this is really what the UCT, I think, has managed to do. And so they kick up with the aim of that all the work we do, and this is as a trust or as an individual, should ideally be aiming towards ending all crimes against mankind and the earth. And that's any of mankind, really, because anything that's causing harm, loss or damage to anybody is a crime. And most of what's being done is causing harm, loss and damage to somebody. And these crimes are being perpetrated by governments that might be elected. More or less nowadays it seems they're not being elected, and anyway we're getting coalition governments that aren't any kind of representative at all. They're being visited, these crimes are being visited upon the earth by corporations, by miscellaneous organisations, by individuals, and by legal entities of all kinds of nature and description. I can't remember whose podcast it was I was listening to that was talking about, I think it was a Chinese saying, which says that the fish stinks from the head, meaning that a dead or dying fish is going to die from the head backwards. And that kind of idea, that kind of model, if you like, is exactly what's expressed by the idea that all of the crimes that are being perpetrated are being perpetrated by governments and corporations and organisations. But it was pointed out in the podcast that I was listening to that that actually, by definition, in order for the head of the fish to stink, the body of it's got to be stinking a bit as well. This stuff has all come about as a result of the seeding of influence, the seeding of power that only belongs with flesh and blood entities to corporations which are not flesh and blood entities and have no mind and can make no decisions. And it's maintained in the position that it's in by our continuing, albeit accidental, consent to the million little things that happen to us, such as parking on double yellow lines or paying for a TV license or all these other things. But one way or the other, it is our consent that lies at the root of it all, both its cause and its maintenance. So when we say an end to all crimes against mankind and the earth, we really do mean that it's not just the corporations and the organisations that need to be seen to, but it's our own mindset, It's the way we think, the way we respond to the world around us, which takes us again really back to this idea about writing stuff about people which is not verifiable and is going to be believed by other people who've got no other means of getting information. Not causing harm to mankind and the earth includes not writing that kind of material. And I know this sort of thing works. It kind of realises as one goes through life that that little lessons, little apparently inconsequential things that we see turn out to be not just applicable to the little lesson that we've just had. Non-critical approach. Yeah, some of you will know, at this time of year, I take to the boards in a Living Willow Theatre that we planted about 8 years ago, and we do one of Shakespeare's plays each year as a community group, so it's all done by volunteers. The theatre's a kind of Living Willow thing, and it's all powered by wind and solar electricity, and it is all really quite an extraordinary experience. But the point that I want to make here is that we go from a read-through of the play, and not everybody is as able to take on the sense of the thing, because Shakespeare can be quite difficult if you're not familiar with him. We go from a read-through, which is many people's first introduction to the text, to having finished our performances in a total of about 4 or 5 weeks. So we go from knowing nothing about it to being able to actually do the whole thing with a good degree of flair and competence in simply 5 weeks. That's a really brilliant demonstration of what can actually be pulled off, because it's pretty complicated between, you know, all of that acting and the talking and the knowing of the words, and you need all these little props to make the illusion fully effective, props and costumes and lighting, and you have to take the weather on board and all of that. It's a massively complicated thing. So the fact that that in itself can be pulled off when absolutely nobody is getting paid anything for doing it, and I certainly don't think the costs of it are ever covered by the ticket sales, because it's a very small theatre. But one way or the other, that in itself is a yearly demonstration for me of what people who are working to a given aim, what kind of quality of output they can turn out. And it's people of all sorts, really people of all sorts, all ages, all competences. And the thing in particular about it is that the overall vision, if you like, the authorization, as we might call it, of the play, of the presentation, is completed by the people who are doing the direction. And we have a couple of very lovely directors that are really, I suppose, to all intents and purposes, they're the kind of, as far as we have them, they're the head honchos of the whole piece. But the point is, they get the results from this theatre company by being entirely uncritical. And I really do mean that, absolutely. We're aware that many directors in the films, because I think that's what we're most likely to see examples of in the modern age, are can be quite strict and difficult to work with, a bit like the chefs people apparently see in these cooking programmes on the telly. That they can be extremely demanding, they can be, they can really want exactly one thing and not another, they can really seriously not want what a particular actor is doing in front of the camera for them to be doing it, all that kind of stuff. And so the choice of the actors, the people who are actually, the individuals who are actually making the story, who are actually making the illusion for the audience on the night, are extremely limited. They get kind of herded into like a little pen where they have to stay. Well, the way ours work is that everything is done by friendly encouragement, and that misunderstanding or not understanding the text well enough to be able to put it across to a modern audience is dealt with quietly by somebody sidling up to you and going, what do you think they mean when they're saying that? Or why do you think why do you think the character says that? So they're using one of our methods, which is to ask questions. Comments are extremely few and far between, and negative comments are kept to an absolute minimum. In fact, in all the years I've been working with them, I can't really remember them having a go at anybody. So this whole thing is done through encouragement and through the drawing out from individuals of what the individual is going to do under the circumstances. So I can imagine, you know, given that the money is completely imaginary anyway, given that even if it does exist, it's actually debt and not money anyway. The money can only, in the long run, in some way that perhaps is invisible to us right now, simply and only be getting in the way. And certainly in Mid Wales, I've seen several things that work this way, that are actually perpetuated, long-living undertakings of one sort or another that are done with just enough money coming in to cover the costs, and that's it. So when I think about an end to all crimes against mankind and the earth, I'm thinking about it not only from the macro level of the economics and social events and all these other things, but I'm thinking that it's really, again, a bit like the fact that we're out there acting in the public from a private position is affecting everybody. I think that our own approach is as important to this change of ending all crimes as is the eventual dissolution or the making useful of corporations, whichever of the two turns out to be possible. But I think it's an absolutely fantastic aim to have absolutely at the top of the list of general things, a general benchmark against which things can be judged. If it is a crime against mankind and the earth, then quite clearly it's something we no longer want to have anything to do with. If we know that our taxes are going to a fund which is purely and simply being used to cause harm, loss and damage to brothers and sisters on anywhere else on this beautiful blue globe, then clearly it's out of the question. But perhaps it's neutral, perhaps the thing we're going to do isn't really going to have an effect one way or the other on whether or not crimes are being committed. And I think we all owe ourselves time like that. I think we do. But to consider that all of our activity might work towards an end to all crimes against mankind, that our meditations might do it, that our prayers, however it is we want to put this across, that our thoughts, because we're encouraging ourselves not to be critical of other people, that our very thoughts, that our intent, actually, it seems that the physical reality that is so apparent around us is very much moulded by intents that somehow comes from our consciousnesses. It's even possible that the things we're looking at out there are not things at all, that they themselves are consciousnesses. So this ending of all crimes involves only partly our concentration on the corporations. And in fact, it might even be worth considering that all of that is simply a distraction. That simply by turning our intent and our action to being all of it, an attempt to end crimes, to a great extent, perhaps the reason why the body of the fish is stinking is because people are just turning their eyes away from the stuff that's going on when action is what's required. So it seems to me, as I've said before, that at this moment in time, knowing about these things is no longer enough. Talking about them with people who already know what's going on is no longer enough. That some kind of action, even if it be only minor, is necessary. And that way, every single one of us who knows is making a little bit of a difference to every single person who witnesses that knowledge in action. I'm getting a bit dry here, and I do actually have a glass of beer and a glass of water, so I'm going to play a bit of music, and then I'll come back to you with a little bit more of that. Actually, it's clearing my mind up as I speak, which I think is possibly the best kind of radio there can be, is that I'm getting to understand things anew simply by talking to you. Still, here come, hopefully, a couple of tunes, and I will be back with you in 5 or 6 minutes. Ta for being there, folks. Absolutely every single one of you. I shall raise my glass to the whole bloody lot of you, the whole TNS, IMS thing. It's exactly what we need, and we are definitely, definitely going forward. It's quite clear, and it was right from the moment when everything looked to be going iffy, that what we are experiencing here is not a breakdown, is most certainly a breakthrough. That was Horace X and Mr. Sims Doesn't Like Us. don't fight with tradition, dance with it. That's what I say. Sitting in on a cooling seat for Vin, who's abandoned us for other pastures. I really look forward to seeing what he's coming up with next, but it's a strange place to be sitting working rather than listening, let's put it that way. And obviously work ain't the right word for it as well, because it ain't work, it's fun. And I love doing it. I love you all as well. And thanks for the positive feedback in the chat box. It really is helpful under such circumstances. I've been working through some of the ideas that we've been talking about in the Universal Community Trust in my time involved with it. It being one of the projects out of the many that I saw in all those festivals that I thought really did look like its heart was in the right place, and that however it was going to work out, it was definitely a well-intentioned and fully backed up means of approaching more generally the many varied and specific challenges and opportunities that we face at these fantastic times. We definitely got a bargain ride for our money, I reckon, this one. It's well exciting, isn't it? I mean, the Alton Towers, who needs it? Let's just have the real thing. But as well as these kind of the individual intent that's involved in dismantling the system that we have mantled, we really, it is our intent, it is our confused and conditioned reflexes that are leading to the state of things that there are around us. The more peaceful our mind is, the more peaceful the world manifests. Something that I've spoken about many times before, and I think it's going to be coming up again and again, because as my own life slows down and as I find myself more closely interrelating with people and with the environment that I find myself moving through, I find that its responses are becoming more gentle. Life used to be a lot more brutal than it is now. So even with all of these really crazy things that we're helping to have visited upon us, it is my firm conviction that sorting out our own minds is the main thing. The main thing. Helping to sort out other people's minds, well, that's really cool. If we can do it through our action, and if we can do it when we're asked to and all of that, and we can get genuine results, that's great. But the only real gift we've got to offer the world is our own personal transformation, and through that the world itself will transform. But apart from that, as a means of ending all crimes against mankind and the earth, clearly the corporations and the organisations do need to be addressed. And when push comes to shove, what has to be done, as point two on the UCT treaty, is the dismantling of all industries which cause actual damage, harm, injury or loss to mankind and or the earth by developing, manufacturing and exploiting for profit any, and exploiting for profit any substance, product or byproduct which has or causes such a detrimental effect. And that again is something that might well not seem, not be as difficult as it first appears, because we have seen really brilliant things come up with and then destroyed even in my lifetime. Mid Wales, where I spend most of my time really, because it is such a beautiful place to be, used to have loads of little railway lines going to all manner of tiny little out of the way places, and they were beautiful. You can still see them, you can still see where the old railway lines used to run between various bits of field and common land and things like that. They would have been lovely trains to pass on, and they worked really well. And yet it was decided that once the motor car became obviously a much more expensive and individually applicable means of getting around the place, we were sustainably and without remorse, it appears, encouraged into individual transport rather than onto a system that was working really well and would have been much, much more economical and less harmful to society as a whole. Not only is it a better means of transport, there's also the opportunity, of course, for plenty of your interrelation, and there's the chance of synchronicitous meetings of people and the exchange of ideas in a sort of one-off, never-to-be-repeated meeting and all of that. Loads and loads of things which would have most certainly been advantageous to us at this point that have disappeared. So already we've come up with many great things that have done us some really huge favours, and if developed and enhanced and grown, then we'd have seen further benefits. And we've seen those things, anything that works that way more or less now, completely removed and replaced with something which is expensive, time consuming, and shall we say, administratively costly. So we know already that that things can be dismantled. That's not a problem. We know also that things can be put together because it's been done before. And when push comes to shove, all of that stuff is done by individuals. It's done by people. It's done by little soul sources of inspiration and action doing the thing they need to do as part of the bigger picture. It is not done by corporations or by banks or by organisations or legal entities. It's done by flesh and blood effort and by inspiration in the neurons of men and women. But quite apart from that, quite apart from the fact that we know that we can take things apart and put them together again, because we've done both of those things before, it's also quite clear now, and anybody who's listening to the fantastic Shaziz over the weekend on I'm so used to saying TNS Radio, I'm just going to say TNS Radio, damn it, until it becomes clear what our new labels are going to be. You only got to listen to Shaziz to realise that there is a whole world out there of things that we just don't quite have access to. It may have been true, in fact it quite possibly was true sort of 100 years ago, that had we been as individuals where we are now, we would not have been able to find the replacements for the damaging systems that have been set up. But we know now, do we not, that there are many things out there, many technologies and awarenesses about the way the human body works, which make it possible to replace insanely expensive, environmentally damaging and ugly means of, say, producing power with tiny little means of producing power. And whilst I suppose it's a great thing, I guess, that individual houses are being encouraged to generate their own hot water and generate their own electricity and things like that, but the hot water goes to the house. Nearly all of the electricity, as far as I can see in these projects, is going straight onto a grid, and that there are benefits coming from doing that in the form of meaningless promissory tokens, but that by and large, it would be much better, would it not, if the electricity being generated by the houses was going into the houses and distributed from there into the locale, rather than onto a massive grid. But nonetheless, in terms of generating energy, in terms of communicating with each other, in terms of entertaining each other, we have got a million things that can be done now that we would not have been able to do in the past. We have miles better technological solutions to ancient problems than we've seen perhaps for thousands of years. I think that some of them are probably pretty old ideas. So again, one of the ways of dismantling all of the industries is not going to be, I mean, a lot of it's been done for us, let's face it, there's not very much of it left. But once again, the true dismantling only comes with the replacement. And once again, it's, I reckon, as much down to individuals as it is down to the macro system, as it were. We've seen a lot of the great ideas that came about with the internet, and I'm thinking specifically off the top of my head about Skype and YouTube, both of which have recently been corporatized and are suffering hugely in terms of their usefulness as a result. But the point is that YouTube and Skype and the Ning Network, of course, and loads of things that I probably don't even know about, all came about as the result of inspiration in probably one or two or three minds, which was then worked at and exactly with the unfailingly committed approach that I was describing earlier when referring to TNS and solid state logic and their mixing desks. This all the work that needs to be done in the first 2, 3 or 4 years to take an idea into something that is not only usable, but actually able to be used. That was all done. All of these things, all the best things, all of the things have come about as a result of that kind of inspiration. So in the end, the best way of dismantling something that is not effective is to replace it slowly but surely with something that is effective. And I'm sure that's already happening, and I know myself, you can see little nodes of it on the internet, where some of the alternative technologies, some of the things that are going to replace Skype and are going to replace things that have been suborned, are already being worked on. The ideas have been there for a long time, and I'm sure that with a bit of resource, a bit of attention, then they would just blossom. Certainly, it has to be said that there's a fair amount of pressure operating downwards to try and make sure that these ideas do not come about. And things like copyright and patenting, it seems to me, are exactly the way of keeping generally useful ideas more or less completely secret or unuseful. But I think the time of them is now fast moving away. The thing is that we choose new solutions quite often as a race as a result of pressure that's being exerted upon us from outside. That's when solutions really start blossoming, only when necessity demands that they blossom. And so I expect that as the systems we're using become ever more obviously completely futile, like I say, what the hell are we doing handing people in a council thousands of pounds just because we want to live or dwell in a certain place when they can't even keep the toilets open? How many other things are not now being done? So we can see the circumstance under which our own individual effort might pay off. It's definitely not going to pay off in fiscal or monetary terms, but it might pay off just in enabling a new means of living to come about. So once again, the effort of individuals is what's going to do that, I reckon. It's going to be ideas that you and I possibly haven't heard of yet that are just going to become available when we need them. So the dismantling of all industries which cause actual damage, harm, injury and loss is going to come about as a result of us getting means of doing things as we used to do them. Not only not causing damage, harm, injury or loss, but actually contributing to the welfare of the planet on which we live, to the diversities of things that are living within it and on it, and to leave the place better for the generations that are to come. To work on everything we do to leave it in better condition, more worthy of use and more reliable than it was when we found it. So once again, it isn't simply just a matter of not causing damage, harm, injury or loss. It's a matter of working sustainably to ensure that the opposite of those things occur. That we are working to mend things, to make them easier for people, to make things that have previously not worked well and have worked to the disadvantage of individual men and women, to work to the disadvantage of them, and to make sure that they are not, on a daily basis, losing every single thing that they've ever worked for. Of course, the main thing in dismantling all of that is going to be, as says in point 3 of the UCT Treaty, the deconstruction of unsustainable fiscal systems that would facilitate one man to have and one man to have not, including, without limitation, the abolition of usury in all its forms and the demonopolisation of land rights and mediums of exchange. I'm assuming that's what they said. Trading platforms and the means of communicating, publishing and distributing information. Well, that's another really big aim, isn't it? There's only 4 lines of that there. But we know, because we talk about it lots, the deconstruction of the fiscal system is absolutely crucial, because it's not supplying any credit to us, it is simply supplying us with debt. It's the idea that money can be made out of money is absolutely crippling the entire system, and it's not just interest, it's the sailing on instead of the return of loan notes. And of course, TNS Radio, as was supplying exactly the bang-on solution to that. Mathematically perfected economy uses basically entirely the structures we've got to turn out a system which is mathematically demonstrable. As Mike Montagna points out, there is absolutely no mathematical proof or any other kind of proof that the so-called economics, pseudo-economics that's being run at the moment, is anything other than a fraud. And when I was taught economics at school, it's clear, really, even at your A level, even from the word go, that if supply and demand are responsible for determining how much you pay for something, then the fact that prices are inflexible downwards is proof that that is not actually the case. One way or another, it is simply a way of robbing us. And it is mostly to do with usury, but it's also to do with the retirement of money. I was listening to that Simon Spaniard pod that was being played earlier on about loan notes, and realised, because I always had a bit of trouble with Mike's idea of retiring money, I wondered just exactly what that meant. And then recently I was told by an oldster that in the old days, when they used to write cheque for things, the cheque would go off and it would go into the bank or whatever, and the thing would get paid for, and then the cheque would come back to you so that you could tear it up and throw it in the bin. And of course we see the now that doesn't happen. The cheque just gets passed on and securitised, and more money is made out of it. And on the bigger scale, the same thing happens with our loan notes. Because strictly speaking, you go in, you sign the loan note, you create the money, they steal it off you, you give it back to them on interest that they never publish, so there's no chance of everybody paying back everything that they've borrowed. So that's a nice little doom the system right from the word go. But the other thing, as Simon Spaniard points out, is that once your loan that they stole in the first place has been paid off a second time, you're supposed to get the loan note back. And of course we don't. In fact, as Simon points out, if you try to get the loan note back, they will make all sorts of excuses about how it's got eaten by the cat or has been through the washing machine or something like that. But one way or another, they won't let you have it back, because they want to bung it into the system and securitise it and make money on it and use it for creating more fake credit to lend to people at interest. And I'm sure somebody in the chat box will put me right if I'm wrong, but I guess that's exactly what the difference is between retiring money and not retiring it. So if the basic deconstruction of unsustainable fiscal systems is based, as I suggested might be the case in the earlier point, on replacing it with something that does work and is not fraudulent, then we already have a fully formed solution to that. That one's not a problem at all. But once again, for us to be concentrating on that, I'm trying more and more to not use the gaming tokens. It's still unfortunately necessary to have some every now and then. But we have all manner of other capital we can use. We've got all of the skills, which many of which are now no longer apparently wanted by the corporate society in which we find ourselves, but they can be used in the service of others. And that does two things. It means that we stay busy, our tools don't get to rust up, and it means that at least somebody else's mission is made a little bit easier. But it does other things as well. Something which I am truly grateful for at this moment in time, because it's part of the wave that I'm riding, is that by going around and helping people, and by going around and using your tools and our tools and competences in the service of others, is we build up a thing, the existence of which I hadn't really spotted until very recently, which is, I think it's called social capital. It's a good enough name for it anyway. It means by being useful and friendly and loving and trying only to put out good stuff and not put out bad stuff, and by being properly tooled up and by being able to do the things one claims to be able to do, and by turning up and doing them, slowly but surely people get to trust us and want us around a bit more. And it means that should we find ourselves needing a roof over our head or a meal or actually, as it turns out, all manner of other things, then one individual or another, somewhere about the place who has been affected by our activity, is going to say, it's cool, you can use some of mine, come and stay here for a while, and all of that. So that's another thing that is made nothing of, as far as I'm aware. It's a completely new idea to me, even though it's been a major part of my life for the last 18 months or so, that we do build up credit in ways that are not money. And we do that fundamentally by helping people. It's also, yeah, that's basically it, really. That, once again, the deconstruction of fiscal systems and the replacement of them by something else, and we're going to need some kind of exchange tokens, say, because we've had them for a very, very long time now. But it's probably also helpful to realise that payment, for want of a better word, comes in many other forms, and that if we all had social capital with everybody else, if we all knew and trusted each other or had reason to trust each other, then we'd find it a lot easier to form communities and to be able to take advantage out of forms of capital that are, believe you me, completely and totally something utterly different from the system that we normally inhabit. Getting rid of established trading platforms, I think that's another important point, because the trading platforms are not doing us any good at all. I don't really want to go into them in any detail. It's at once a very interesting and a very boring subject, how various corporations just become bigger and bigger until they become corporations of country or nation-sized corporations. But it is getting more and more difficult to trade in all sorts of things. I suppose the most obvious example at the moment is the new European seed law, which is further endeavouring to tighten up on the number of plants that we can get out there and grow. We still meet up in seed swapping groups and the like to hand over seeds which it would be apparently illegal for us to sell. Show me a job description and a contract. It's getting harder and harder to buy and sell things. There's all manner of interfaces through which stuff has to go, which makes sure that things that are wanted in one place but not wanted in another manage to get kept within bounds. We need to be able to have the what they call a laissez-faire free trade economy, where we can use the skills and the tools we've got to the benefit of ourselves and to others without having the consequences of that activity removed from us in its entirety. Also in that point was we need the abolition of the current control of the means of communicating, publishing and distributing information. Once again, the old ways of doing it was just to burn the books. That's how it was done as the conquistadors arrived in Middle America and all of that. But many, many other ways are used of controlling the communications. Perhaps another of the most obvious examples would be to say, well, just look at what the television is used for. Look at what a sad and debilitating effect it has on people. And imagine what it would be like if there's 24 hours a day and 100 channels of useful information. Stuff on how to keep your mind and body flexible. Stuff on how to deal with the world as you find it, rather than how to become subservient to it. A complete change, that would be as well. Once again, though, for all of our activities to be directed not only not to the sustaining of a fiscal system which is corrupt and fraudulent, but to work actively just a little bit at a time. It doesn't mean kind of like swinging at the whole thing and saying I ain't going to use money anymore. It just means finding little ways of bartering, ways of making other people's missions easier that make your mission easier and cost nobody anything in terms of gaming tokens. And the key part of all of that is the nullifying, settlement and discharge of all outstanding or allegedly owed debts, obligations and liabilities with a view to replacing unaccountable, unsustainable and inequitable usury-based financial systems with localized and autonomous permanent credit facilities or gift economies or whatever. In the end, I guess we have to imagine that the currency such as it is will be replaced with something more useful. But in the meantime, the nullifying and settlement and discharge of alleged debts would be a really good idea. It is something that used to happen in the Bible. They had jubilee years when all borrowed tap went back to the person that it was borrowed from and everything was set back to zero. At some point this clearly changed, which has allowed us to be taking on the interest on the debts that were taken on by our fathers and their fathers' fathers and their fathers' fathers' fathers and all of that. And that means finding other ways of trading, like I say. in the end though, the credit that is being created and then stolen, there's absolutely no reason why that sort of credit shouldn't be created, not stolen and not charged interest on. And if, as and when that can be brought about, as I'm sure it's going to be because something's going to have to happen, then our own depositories, our own credit facilities are exactly what we needed. And I presume at some point, before we got the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve, that must have been something like what happened. I know that at least three American presidents did try to introduce such a system, so they obviously had some confidence that it would work. And the thing that Mike Montagna, as highlighted earlier, has definitely shown that none of this is really a problem. They're our documents, it's the credit we're creating from the fact that we're here doing useful things for other people. You're listening to Dr. Rock sitting in on an empty chair for Vin, the father of all that's going on here, and big thanks to him. I'm going to come to the end of the talky bit. Now I'm going to carry on playing tunes as long as nobody comes along and kicks me off. I recommend a look at the rest of the items in the FreeThePlanet.net or UCT treaty, because as a means of giving ourselves some core intents that, if implemented by just a few individuals, are going to start making a lot of difference. There are already many people working on it because they want to and all of that, but the idea of unifying mind and intent in not only causing no damage, but in improving the planet on which we find ourselves and improving, as far as possible, the environment, the circumstances in which everybody lives and dwells and has their being, and to work solidly towards ensuring that anybody who's not fulfilling those general aims, anybody who is deliberately and with malice aforethought and for gaming tokens only causing other people's potential to be limited, is reduced and brought to a stop. Because it is possible for us to work towards the eradication of all forms of artificial scarcity, because that's what it is. As I was coming up here on the bus from Mid Wales, all I bloody saw in the field of Wales, England and Scotland was sheep. Loads and loads of sheep. And actually more and more windmills and communication masts and other things which enable farmers to use their land for getting money for things which doesn't even involve growing the food. We've got a fantastic climate here. There's many, many things that will grow. We could have been looking at a tapestry of permacultural events and veg gardens and fields full of, I don't know, llamas and alpacas and Lord knows what else. There are a million, million things that we could be doing in this countryside of ours. And if they were being done, then scarcity would be a thing of the past. It's a bounteous planet. But it really requires the effort of humans to make soil and to care for the things that are happening under its auspices. Dissolution of fossil fuel industries, including all of them really, coal seam, gas mining, coal-fired power stations, oil drilling. And as a result of getting rid of a lot of that, we'd see certainly the reduction in chemical pollution of the biosphere of the Earth. We need to see as part of that the rapid development and manufacture and implementation of free and clean energy technologies in every community upon the Earth. Ceasefire in all wars, because that's just loads and loads of resource and stuff going for things that are only going to be used once and that are only going to be used for causing harm, loss and damage to someone. There can't possibly be any genuine benefit in it at all. Establishment of cooperative trade networks between ourselves is also something that we seriously need to be moving towards. The UCT is doing that. There's lots of other kind of cooperative trade work networks going on. It's something that sprung up in Greece as a result of the need for it to happen, because people could no longer get reasonably priced food from their supermarkets. And so they're suddenly developed just out of the blue a kind of network of volunteer runners and all manner of other things to ensure that food was going directly from farms to the people who actually needed the food. It'd be really helpful if we could have some farms out there growing food to start with. And what we need to see most of all is a re-emergence of a bond of trust between people, a bond of common unity, because that's what we are, we're here on the earth, all of us, and we all do have common interests, and the community has a common interest, and I'm sure it's what we used to feel. It's the way the planet was perhaps a long, long time ago and the peoples upon it. But that is what we're all working towards here, I reckon. And I think we're a major force for that here on this radio station, all the people that are taking part in it, the people that are maintaining the amazing website, all the hosts that are kind of putting all their own individual might and muscle behind the thing, and all because it needs to be done. There ain't no washers passing hands here. So I'm going to finish just by saying thanks very much, really, still, for letting me to keep coming back on and talk. I'm going to sort the technology out so that people can call me and I can actually have talks with other people instead of just sitting here addressing you, which will be really brilliant. I'll be able to do that from anywhere. In the meantime, thanks to all of those people who helped get the laptop set up so that it could do this actually without any other tackle attached to it at all. Thanks to everybody who's out there doing the work. And onwards and upwards, that's where we're going. All shall be well, all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, like the lady said. Well, I'm going to leave you with, that's the end of the talky bit for tonight. I'm going to probably mostly bid you farewell on the talking thing. I shall put some tunes on, which I can then go and listen to in the other room, so if anything goes wrong, I will know. I'll keep my eye on the host box in case anybody else wants to come on. Thanks to Johnny for doing a cracking job last night on playing tunes whilst we had a lot of Scottish sovereigns travelling through the place yesterday, and a really, really five-star soundtrack, I thought, was supplied to the whole thing. But I'm going to, by way of something else for you to listen to, I'm going to play I'm going to play an Arlo Guthrie track. It's a nice little piece of guitar and ballad and sort of narrative, giving us a bit of help with what happens if you cede subject matter jurisdiction on the small matter of littering. I just want to say a big personal thanks to Vin and for everything that he's made possible for me, and to all the ideas in my head that have been straightened out as a result of listening to Vin's voice and the voices of the amazing people that he's talked to over the years here. And I know he's not going to be sitting idle with his feet up, so I really look forward to seeing what he comes up with next. And in the meantime, guys, it's up to us. We've got a fine thing here. Let's use it with maximum prejudice, eh? I'll see you all soon, folks. Tarpa being there. This is Arlo Guthrie and Alice's Restaurant from 1967.